Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, religious freedom, the path to peace. Pope Benedict's message for World Peace Day 2011 focuses on religious and secular fundamentalism, threatening the innate dignity and freedom of individuals and communities. Religious Freedom, the Path to Peace. That's the title of Pope Benedict's message for World Peace Day, celebrated by the Church on January the 1st each year. Released by the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council at a press conference in the Vatican on December the 16th, the message opens with a dramatic reminder of the recent attack on the Cathedral of Our Lady of Salvation in Baghdad, a glaring example of what happens when religious freedom is denied. Recalling all those who suffer persecution and discrimination in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and in particular the Holy Land, Pope Benedict urges Catholics to pray and to support all victims of violence and intolerance. Let's listen to the Pope's words of concern for Iraq, spelt out in this Peace Day message.
My thoughts turn in a special way to the beloved country of Iraq, which continues to be a theatre of violence and strife, as it makes its way towards a future of stability and reconciliation. I think of the recent sufferings of the Christian community, and in particular the reprehensible attack on the Syro-Catholic Cathedral of Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Baghdad, where on the 31st of October, two priests and over 50 faithful were killed as they gathered for the celebration of Holy Mass. In the days that followed, other attacks ensued, even on private homes, spreading fear within the Christian community and a desire on the part of many to emigrate in search of a better life. I assure them of my own closeness and that of the entire Church.
While Pope Benedict condemns religious fanaticism and fundamentalism, he also warns in this message of what he sees as the equally dangerous threat of secularism and hostility towards religious practice and principles in civil or political life. Religious fundamentalism and secularism are alike, the message states, in that both represent extreme forms of a rejection of legitimate pluralism and the positive secularity of states.
Religious freedom expresses what is unique about the human person, for it allows us to direct our personal and social life to God, in whose light the identity, meaning, and purpose of the person are fully understood. To deny or arbitrarily restrict this freedom is to foster a reductive vision of the human person, to eclipse the public role of religion, is to create a society which is unjust, inasmuch as it fails to take account of the true nature of the human person. It is to stifle the growth of the authentic and lasting peace of the whole human family.
This disrespect for the dignity of the individual and how, you know, it gives expression to this dignity in seeking after truth, in seeking after God, and manifesting this in terms of, you know, human relationship and all of that. If we were to circle that out of human existence, then the world would be poorer, you know, for that.
Cardinal Peter Turkson from Ghana is president of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council. I asked him to tell us more about the content and the goals of this year's World Peace Day message. Pope Benedict has spoken extensively in the past about religious freedom, significantly in 2008 when he visited the United Nations. What do you think is the novelty, the most significant feature of this particular message?
I think the novelty or the newness that this message brings is probably the context, and it's probably, you know, when and at the time it's taking place. Naturally, when he visited the UN, it was basically to do with what the UN as an institution stood for, the Universal Declaration of, you know, Human Rights, and he referred to that as the United Nations having given a language, you know, to all nations, I mean, an ethical structure for all nations, you know, to go by and to walk by. This time, we're just taking one of those human rights, you know, declared by the United Nations, which is, you know, Article 18, I think. And that's more about, you know, the freedom, religion, what we refer to as a religious freedom. And it has come up this day because in the light of so very many things happening. For example, the issue of secularism has rendered every talk about God and religion less tolerant, okay? And still worse with anything about religious practice, religious expression. All of that is increasingly being pushed into like some private domain and nothing for the public arena or public place.
It's very striking how the Pope condemns religious fundamentalism, but also, as you mentioned, this secular fundamentalism. He says one is as serious as the other.
It is. And probably while it's easy even sometimes to identify religious fundamentalism because you can see where it's coming from its traits. Secular fundamentalism is more difficult to deal with. It's more difficult because it becomes, as it were, a pervasive culture in which people live. And then that gets expressed also in its forms of governance, okay, so that imperceptibly you have governments assuming and adopting certain positions which are not too friendly, you know, to the human spirit and human growth. Secular fundamentalism is also diminishing the lifestyle and the quality of life for so very many other people. If people need to, you know, be free and express themselves and aspiring after those type of things which respond to their innate nature and character and are afraid to do this in public or feel embarrassed to do this in public, then you having people living, as it were, in a like, you know, psychotic type of lives or not. All there are very subtle psychological forms of expression which we need to recognize when we talk about, you know, secular fundamentalism or the secular culture forcing people to adopt certain modes of forms.
This message is directed to all people of goodwill, but definitely, it is a direct challenge, isn't it, to governments and to legislators?
It is. You know, you look at the title religious, you know, freedom, and the tendency is to think that this is only about, you know, faith, religion, and groups like that. But if religious freedom is recognized as a response to basic expression of a personal dignity of individuals, then, you know, it's not something that refers only to those who kneel in churches and pray. Then we're talking about something that responds to the basic intrinsic expression of the human spirit, okay? And ultimately is the capacity, it is the longing of the human spirit for what is basically true about itself, about its relationship with other people, ultimately about relationship with God. Okay, all of that belongs to religious freedom. This capacity to give expression to this intrinsic longing, it's almost like listening to St. Augustine say that there's no stronger desire within the human spirit than the, you know, the desire for the truth. You know, if that is the case, then you don't need to put God there for people to recognize that they're dealing with God, but they would do something that is within every person.
The transcendental
aspect, that's within every person. And if we label the transcendental truth, it's because we go on from there to recognize that this is rooted in the fact of our creation by God. Okay, so the basic character of our being is that we're created by God. And that relationship is what gets expressed in terms of, you know, in religious terms. But we are basically dealing with this basic innate longing within the human soul. This is very positive because it leads to the construction, the build-up of, you know, decent social order, which promotes the advancement and the search for the common good, which ultimately makes for the peace of humanity. That's what this message is all about.
Religious freedom is not the exclusive patrimony of believers, but of the whole family of the earth's peoples. It is an essential element of a constitutional state. It cannot be denied without, at the same time, encroaching on all fundamental rights and freedoms, since it is their synthesis and keystone. It is the litmus test for the respect of all the other human rights. While it favors the exercise of our most specifically human faculties, it creates the necessary premises for the attainment of an integral development which concerns the whole of the person in every single dimension.
The message also defends the right or upholds the right of people to change their religion or indeed not to hold any religious belief at all. This is a particular challenge, isn't it, to the Islamic regimes which see this as leaving your Muslim faith as a kind of treason.
This is a very, you know, subtle aspect of this subject matter. You know, when we talk about religious freedom, we recognize, of course, that the UN came up with this. And in the UN, in Article 18 of the UN, in our declaration of, Universal Declaration, freedom of religion is freedom, you know, of conscience, to believe, to change, whatever. All of those are involved. When, however, within the Catholic Church, we talk about religious freedom, we're talking not so much about the freedom to choose between one A and B, one religion from another, between whatever. That's not the first and primary sense of religious freedom when we talk about this in the church. In the church, religious freedom is first and foremost what I just said, that this basic innate longing of a man, of a person, to seek for the truth, to long for the truth, to find the truth and all. That for us is the basic sense of religious freedom. And when that is the case, the truth is one.
The message also underlines the importance of dialogue with other religions about this issue, doesn't it? It's a subject very close to your own heart, too, isn't it?
Very close. It is just that the message recognizes that the different pursuits of truth can bring us all to bring together our resources, inspiration, and ideas for and work for the common good. That is possible. So the dialogue situations are, you know, just recognize our, you know, various approaches to this truth would enable us to develop positive, you know, elements and traits which can be brought together for the advancement of the common good. In that sense, the different pursuits or the different initiatives of dialogue within the church, you know, whether it's that with, you know, non-Christian religions or even with, you know, other Christian religions, all of that have this as an objective. And I may refer to a particular example. As you probably know, there is a Cardinal Lucie Foundation, which does an ongoing dialogue and meeting with Jews in New York almost every year. I have participated in that, you know, two or three times. And I refer to it because at the last meeting when we were talking about it, one of the rabbis, they made it absolutely clear what for them this dialogue is all about and leading to. And it wasn't a question of discussing, coming together to discuss whose view or perception of God is true, whose will know. It's just that from our different, you know, religious experiences, we can come together to address certain common issues which diminish our lives here as Christians, whatever. So, you know, be the issue of the environment or whatever type of... So it's like coming together as a religious group to address certain common issues.
So, in fact, interfaith dialogue should be focused much more on cooperation on these common concerns rather than real theological dialogue about the faith.
It is not this or that. Sometimes clarifying certain theological issues open the way wider to be able to bring together these resources to do what we need to do. Okay? Sometimes, you know, skewed perceptions of one's whatever sometimes keep us apart. So sometimes a discussion of that also comes in. Okay? To see how far, sometimes we're not so far apart after all. But it's the way we've perceived. And our prejudices are there and they exist. And they sometimes keep us apart. So sometimes some clarification of issues are necessary to bring us more close together and help us, you know, bring our resources, you know, together to do what we need to do.
This Peace Day message, the theme is announced back in July, so it's obviously been in the works for many, many months. And yet it opens with this very striking example of the brutal attack on the Church of Our Lady of Salvation in Baghdad. It's particularly timely in this sense, isn't it?
That's why, you know, in response to your first question about what is special about this, but I refer to the context. What happened in Iraq is, as it were, you know, just pushed strongly to the forefront just the very many other similar manifestations and instances that, you know, we've been witnessing in around the world. This one in Iraq was people entering the church to do what they did. But elsewhere, we've had people, you know, you heard of cases in Nigeria sometimes. You had cases in southern Sudan, the clash between them, the ongoing fight and battle. There are different cases, like, you know, the case in the Balkans, okay? Different religious clashes have always been there. And that comes to the general background, but that of Iraq is, as it were, holds up the chair and says, look, that's the naked face of this religious intolerance and how it can lead us to be real murderers and give rein to the worst sentiments within us.
Yeah. What do you hope this message can do in this, as you say, very dramatic context?
You know, although as I observed, that the church's understanding of religious freedom is not just limited to UN formulation, but it's good to have the UN formulation also in view. And it is basically to say that, look, all of you nations, you did ratify this years ago. Okay, now, failure to respect it is what is occasioned this reminder. Okay, so in that sense then, this message can be seen as a reminder of something which nations have already subscribed to, committed themselves to, you know, since 1948. As a church, however, in addressing this over and above the reminder, we want to add the fact that it is not just a reminder, you know, of people stepping or coming out of a war, the Second World War, but it's also the way of ensuring peace.
I believe that the Holy Father's message in this regard carries a lot of weight, and people really listen to the Holy Father when he speaks.
Monsignor Anthony Frontiero follows problems of religious intolerance for the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council. He told me more about how this annual message is drawn up.
The concept of religious freedom is certainly nothing new to the social doctrine of the Church. It's a fundamental human right. We believe that. That's enshrined in all international constitutions, and certainly it's also enshrined in international organizations in their effort to promote peace and justice in the world. And so the actual theme for this year's message came about through an interdicastorial meeting where we kind of surface ideas together, and then we present some suggestions to the Holy Father, who then makes the final decision on what to engage for this particular message, which, as you know, is very important. It comes on the first day of the new year, January 1st. We also celebrate the solemnity of Mary, Mother of God, but we also have incorporated this idea of the World Day of Peace as we begin a new year together as a human family. And so the Church has something to say on this theme each year to the world. And the Holy Father this year has chosen the theme of religious liberty as the path to peace, because we're realizing now that religious freedom is very much at risk in many parts of the world, both in developed countries and in developing countries. The Holy Father in this message signals for us two bookends to that challenge and that risk, one being fundamentalism and extremism and fanaticism. The other one would be the risks involved with secularization or relativism. Both of those realities and those phenomena sort of try to marginalize the authentic religious freedom that every human person is entitled to by virtue of their creation in the image and likeness of Almighty God. The fact that we are created by God gives everyone a dignity that is equal and inherent. And as the Catholic social doctrine teaches, perhaps the second most important fundamental human right is the right to religious freedom, to be able to worship and honor one's Creator. And that right entails both a private dimension and a communal public dimension. And now those dimensions are also spelled out in most national constitutions and international organization and instruments of human rights. But we've seen over the years, and more recently, actually, where that fundamental human right has been denied or severely restricted. So this year's message is really providential, I think, because particularly of what has been happening in the Middle East with the Christian community. We're very concerned about that small group of faithful Christians whose plight is well known to us now in the face of the massacre on October 31st in Baghdad while the Christians were celebrating Holy Mass. But it has been a problem now that we've seen on many, many different fronts in many areas of the world. So we need to be concerned.
The message specifically says that Christians are the most persecuted of all religious groups today. Where are those kind of statistics, if you like, the figures drawn from?
Virtually every human rights group and Western government agency that monitors the plight of Christians worldwide arrives at more or less the same conclusion, and that is that between 200 and 300 million Christians face daily threats of murder, beating, imprisonment, and torture. And a further 350 to 400 million encounter discrimination areas such as jobs and housing. And so most agencies, including, by the way, the U.S. Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, which is a very valuable monitoring instrument, as well as, for example, UN agencies for Human Rights Watch, as well as, for example, here in Europe, OSHA, the Organization of Security and Cooperation for Europe, which we also mentioned, monitors these incidents. So in all told, given these various instruments of Rights Watch throughout the world, a conservative estimate would indicate that the number of Christians killed for their faith each year is somewhere around 150,000 people. In all told, out of all the statistics on people who are discriminated against or hurt or killed for, persecuted for religious reasons, 75% worldwide are Christian.
As you say, the message opens with the example of this brutal attack on the Christian church in Baghdad, where so many people were killed. Clearly the message was updated, if you like, until the very last moment almost.
Well, I think with this message of the Holy Father, as with Caritas in Veritate, which also ended up by being very providential in that it took account of the financial crisis that we find ourselves in as a human family and examined the causes for this crisis. Likewise, here in the message for the World Day of Peace this year, the Holy Father takes into account the very current plight of the Christians in the Middle East and the seriousness of that crisis for all of us, because it exemplifies the problem that religion is having right now when it is threatened by, in this case, extremist groups who seek to destroy people of other faiths. And so I think in all of these things, as you ask the question, I believe it's very providential, not only very timely, but I think it's very providential that the Holy Father takes this opportunity to address these concerns right where we're at.
It's quite unusual for him to talk about specific people and places in these messages, isn't it?
Well, I think in many of these messages, the Holy Father tries to focus in on the principles, the principles of social doctrine and Catholic teaching that are timeless, that speak to the objective moral truth and the dignity of the human person. But I think in this case, the message really calls for a very strong and pointed reflection. And he's well aware of the need that we have in this regard, not only on behalf of the Christian community, but on the human family. Because if religious freedom is not respected and promoted, then a whole host of other issues become at risk, including the very social fabric that we have and also the very justice and peace that help us to coexist with one another.
As you said at the beginning, these freedoms, religious freedom, is enshrined in most constitutions. Most governments at least pay lip service to it. What else do you think can this message do? What else can people do to try and uphold or hold people accountable, hold leaders accountable to this?
Well, I think what it does is, on a very basic level, it reminds leaders and those with power that they need to pay attention to the way in which these constitutions enshrine this ideal for everyone. And we need to be reminded, too, of how we fall short of helping our citizens to realize those ideals and the consequences that take place when we fail to do so. Religious freedom is absolutely essential for people, because every human person, as the Holy Father says in this message, has an innate drive and is bound to search for the truth. And God is our ultimate truth. He is our destiny. We're created by Him, for Him. And so to be restricted in that search, in that quest, which is at the very core of who we are as human beings, is detrimental to who we are. And if it's detrimental to who we are as individuals, then that certainly has a ripple effect, and we've seen it historically, and we're seeing it now. That has an effect on the community.
The impact of this peace message, how much does it, do you think, affect the way people reflect on this particular crucial question of religious freedom?
I think the message will have far-reaching effects and a far-reaching impact, particularly with regard to individual nations and leaders, but also a lot of the international organizations who are working constantly at issues of justice and peace. I'm thinking of the Organization of Security and Cooperation for Europe, for example, which I follow fairly closely. And that organization here in Europe, which is made up of 56 states, including the Holy See, is very concerned about intolerance and discrimination against Christians and members of other religions. And it's one of the commitments and the mandate of that organization. And every year, we try to progress in our effort to ensure that there's more mutual understanding among people of different faiths, more respect, and so that justice and peace will reign, and so that hatred and intolerance and discrimination will be reduced. Because I believe that the Holy Father's message in this regard carries a lot of weight, and people really listen to the Holy Father when he speaks. Because I think, as we've seen throughout the centuries, the Church does not have political interests per se. We don't have economic interests or military interests. So the uniqueness of the Holy Father's teaching is that he brings to the fore the expertise in humanity that is the Church's.
My thanks there to Monsignor Anthony Frontiero from the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council. And earlier you heard Cardinal Peter Turkson, president of that same council. And let's close today's programme with Pope Benedict's own words from his message for the 2011 World Day of Peace.
Peace is a gift of God, and at the same time, a task which is never fully completed. A society reconciled with God is closer to peace, which is not the mere absence of war or the result of military or economic supremacy, much less deceptive ploys or clever manipulation. Rather, peace is the result of a process of purification and of cultural, moral, and spiritual elevation involving each individual and people, a process in which human dignity is fully respected.
And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.